Remodeled kitchen, bathroom, or backyard patio? There's a lot of choices, but only one leader, Estate Granite.
Mike Huber has such a professional attitude and a can-do work ethic that makes him a joy to work with. Mike and his crew worked to have our new kitchen finished in 5 days. We came back to a true work of art.
Hi, this is Brian Filato, broker and co-owner of the Real Estate Group. In today's competitive market, I think what's important is that the house is dialed in and turnkey. And what's important is that the kitchen has been renovated, the bathrooms have been renovated, granite, beautiful cabinetry. Those things make a significant difference.
Mike at Estate Granite has an eye for detail, an attention to perfection, and a quality build crew that are masters of their craft. Mike was there from start to finish.
Hi, this is Mike from Estate Granite. I know how important quality to a homeowner is, so give me a call at 241-STONE or come by our showroom at 4900 Mountain Lakes Boulevard or visit us at estategranite.com.
Good morning. You're listening to Common Ground. Usually we have some music, and we're having technical difficulties down here at the station today. I apologize profusely. So this is Common Ground Radio coming to you from downtown Redding, California, Shasta County. And RV, how are you doing today?
I'm great, Christian. I'm trying to keep a positive attitude.
Yes, sir. That's all we can do, right? And there's stuff to be positive about. And today's show, ladies and gentlemen, is about the fact that we have a brand new national holiday and a very important national holiday. In fact, one of the most important national holidays to ever be enacted in our history. RV, what do you think about that?
Well, I dressed up for Juneteenth today. I got my leopard shirt on, and I'm celebrating. And you're right, it's one of the biggest things that's happened, at least in our lifetime. It's long overdue, and as much as it means for African Americans, it should mean a lot for white folks too, because this is the end of a horrible chapter in our history, or at least the start, the beginning of the end was 1865, and we're still trying to finish the job.
But. Yeah, you know, that's a great way to put it. I was listening to Barbara Lee, representative from Bay Area, congressional representative, and she said, you know, folks, what this means is this affirms all the work that has been done, but all the work that needs to continue. In my personal opinion, we have racial inequity in this. Well, we have inequity, period, but especially along racial lines that we have to address. We just have to. And if you're against that, well, I'm going to say, and I'll go out on the diving board here. If you're against addressing that issue, and one of those issues might be
reparations.
Yeah, reparations. If you're against that, you're not American in my view. However, that's just my personal feeling about that. And so the way our show is going to work today is we're going to be playing Lift Every Voice and Sing right now. And RV forgot his guitar and I can't sing. But no, we had a great version queued up. And once again, our board is just not cooperating. So it means we get to dive into the show just a little bit earlier than anticipated. RV, anything before we go to our first guest?
Well, just one idea about how far we have to go. It's, as I understand it, all of the senators unanimously voted to make Juneteenth a national holiday. Yet we can't get 51 senators to pass a voting rights legislation that will stop the what's going on in the 30 Republican-led states where they're trying to reduce people's right to vote. And of course, we know that they're focusing on people of color the most. So that's, you know, if unanimously they can approve the holiday, unanimously they should be able to approve the right to vote.
You know, and that's what Representative Barbara Lee was saying is, look, this is an affirmation that the nation, I think, would recognize this as a common ground that, and in fact, the polling indicates that the majority of people in America are Americans, and they actually support voter reform, whether it's going to be for the People Act or some version of it. But if, you know, having a celebration and having a national holiday is one thing, but people, if we don't follow up with that, so I would like to, at this point, introduce Janelle. Oh, boy, I'm going to get this name. Janelle, are you there?
Here. Can you hear me?
Yes, wow. I'm hearing some.
Janelle, I rebooted the computer.
We've got a reboot on the computer. Is it okay if we play this just in the background for a minute?
Absolutely.
Oh, and so I can at this point go ahead and say that Janelle is the assistant to Reading City Manager, and Janelle is a self-described Army brat who has lived in many states and overseas, has a bachelor's and a master's degree in English, and among other things, Janelle, and you got to correct me if I'm wrong, you oversee special projects for the city council and the city manager, and if we could just hear a couple of more stanzas here, and we'll dive into this thing. So I think what we'll do is we're going to, at the bottom of the hour, we're going to go ahead and play the full version now that we have our computer and our board working. And once again, I apologize. That is such a beautiful and important song. Janelle, correct me right off the bat. How do I pronounce your last name?
It's Galbraith.
Galbraith. Okay. Janelle Galbraith. And Janelle, RV, my cohort, is here with us. You know, we were kind of talking a little bit before about before the interview here is to kind of what, you know, we might want to be talking about. And one of the things that I thought was really interesting is that there's a new initiative that City of Reading is kind of putting into place, and I'd love for you to describe that. But before we go there, Janelle, you've lived in a lot of different places and lived overseas. Janelle, help us out here. What does Juneteenth mean personally to you?
Okay. Well, first, I'm going to apologize. I'm sitting outside. I'm actually out of state right now dealing with a family emergency, so I'm hoping that you don't hear too much of the birds chirping or the wind blowing in the background.
Okay.
But, yes, I have lived in seven states and also overseas, and I'm actually currently in Alabama where my parents live. And living in southern states in the United States, it's a different culture down here. You know, having been in California for the last 5 years, I think sometimes we think in California that we are removed from some of the things that are going on in other parts of the country. And then being down here and also having lived in Texas, I got to tell you, some of these racial issues are front and foremost every single day. So having Juneteenth become a national holiday, it means a lot. My dad was born and raised in Texas. I grew up celebrating Juneteenth. I've always known what it meant. The state of Texas actually declared it a holiday back in 1979. So it has been something that people have celebrated in the state of Texas for a long, long time. Historically, you know, I think we all kind of looked at the Emancipation Proclamation from President Lincoln as a time where slaves were declared free, and unfortunately that's not exactly what happened. That happened, it was signed in September of 1862. It didn't become law until January of 1863. It was January 1st. But it took a whole 2.5 years for the word of that proclamation to reach Texas, and there were a couple of reasons for that. The Emancipation Proclamation was really only geared towards Confederate states, Confederate-controlled states, not to those border states like Texas. So when slaves were freed in Confederate-controlled states, some of those slave owners actually fled to Texas because they knew they could continue to own slaves. And that's what Texas became at that time. It was a place where people could continue to use slaves to increase their harvests and things like that. It wasn't until the Civil War ended in 1865 that Union soldiers actually were dispatched to Texas through the Port of Galveston, and they started to spread the word there. And there was still a lot of resistance. And so it took quite some time for all of the people in Texas to realize that slaves could no longer be enslaved. And then obviously the 13th Amendment was passed about 2 months after the end of the Civil War. So it was a long process, and Texas has a really dark history, because even when they knew they should no longer have been owning slaves, they did, and they continued to harbor people who had that feeling. Juneteenth is considered Jubilee Day. It is Independence Day for black people in this country. You were just singing or playing the Black National Anthem, Lift Every Voice and Sing, and I was even tearing up because I think that has always been a song that has played in church. It's been played at barbecues in the park. I know all the words. It has meaning. And that song talks about how we've got to look at our history so that we learn and we do better in the future. It talks about raising your voices to the sky and saying we are free, and let's try to do the best we can to be a more equal society. So right now, hearing the country kind of celebrate Juneteenth for being what it is, it's a huge step in the right direction. It is not the end game, but it's definitely a beginning. I've heard some people, there are lots of people who feel like we skipped some steps. They're like, you know, there's so many other pieces of the puzzle there to help bridge some of the gap and some of our racial inequality. And they're upset that this was the first step, but I disagree. I think naming this holiday and saying this is a federal time for everyone to stop and recognize that 1776 wasn't independence for everybody, it's a huge step in the right direction. So it definitely has some personal meaning for me. It has personal meaning for my children. It has personal meaning for my family.
Beautiful, a beautiful way to put it. In fact, especially recognizing the freedom of slavery, but you know, in some ways, in our area up here in Shasta County, that applied to Native Americans, it applied to Chinese immigrants, there's some instances, and I think they called it indentured servitude back then, of people from Ireland, you know, working for basically free for the railroads and so forth. So in a way, it does encompass. This is an opportunity to recognize not just for the African American experience, but for all of us, that yes, slavery is not something that was a evil necessity, as one congressional representative put it. Mm-hmm. It was evil, and it is completely against the values and the morals of what America is supposed to be.
Yeah, you know, recognizing this as a holiday actually recognizes that we actually had slavery. There are some senators out there who have professed that we didn't really have slaves. We had indentured servants, and that is so far from the truth. So just recognizing the holiday in itself recognizes that there was slavery, and that that was a wrong thing, and that we did have a moment where we had to make people free. I think just in recognition of the holiday itself, I think that will start some of those conversations, and it'll drive some of the education, even though we have some states who are resistant to being able to teach our history the way it really happened.
Yeah, in fact, some states, and I think we're up to three, are saying, no, we cannot teach about the history of the African-American history and experience in South Carolina, Texas. And what is the other state? I want to say, is it Georgia?
It might be Alabama, actually.
Yeah, oh, my goodness.
Okay. Or Mississippi, who knows?
You know, and these are the, you know, this comes from the political arm that is screaming and yelling about council culture. You know, that we're trying to counsel hamburgers. we're trying to counsel the white experience or blame white people.
Right.
Guilt might be something that somebody might have. But hey, if you got a little bit of guilt, maybe you need to look inside and understand, is there explicit or implicit racism in there that is causing that guilt? Because, you know, there's cognitive dissonance there. And RV, do you got something to say real quick?
Oh, hi, Janelle. It's RV. It was interesting. You started out talking about living and growing up in various southern states and the racism you experienced there. And I know at least several like progressive friends and stuff sometimes refer to rural California as Mississippi, and usually referring to the low income and stuff. And but I wonder how your experience with southern states racism matches with your experience in Shasta County.
You know, it's interesting because I think the lack of diversity in Shasta County contributes to some of probably what I've experienced. I don't know that I can necessarily say that I have experienced hateful racism in Shasta County. It's more ignorant. And it comes from the fact that people just haven't had an opportunity to be around people of other races enough to understand that our cultures are different. We are all people. Every single person has, you know, human traits, but each culture has specific things that are specific to their cultures that make their everyday lives a little bit different than others. And I think that is what we miss in Shasta County a lot. You know, I'm one of those people. I'm obviously black. I don't know if people know that or not. But I wear wigs all the time. And, you know, we talk about it in my office a lot because I come in and my hair is different from one day to the next. And for a while, people thought they would ask me questions like, what did you do? How is your hair short today? How
you try to touch your hair?
They're like, can I touch that? And I'm like, I don't care. Sure. You know, if that's what you want to do. But you know, wearing wigs, wearing weaves, wearing braids, wearing dreadlocks, those things are all cultural in the black community. And hair is incredibly important to our culture. It's inherent in the black community. And one of the things I talk about in my office a lot is that we do not have enough beauticians in Shasta County, Red City of Redding, to do black hair. You know, if I want to get my hair done, I have to either drive to Chico, drive to Sacramento, drive to Oakland. Sometimes I'll hop on a flight and come down and see my parents down south, and I'll get my hair done down here. We just don't have, there are certain cultural things for black people that we are missing in Shasta County. And those are the types of, the racism that I feel like I've experienced in Shasta County comes from omission, I think, and not necessarily from hate.
It makes a lot of sense. I mean, I think the black population here is about, is it 1.5 to 2% or so?
I think it's less than that.
Yeah, it might be. So that makes sense that it would be racism out of just ignorance and just not knowing black culture. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Janelle, we have a caller on the line that would you take a phone call?
Absolutely.
Okay. I think as I understand it, we have Jimmy on the line there. And good morning, Jimmy. And what's your question?
Yeah, now that we have the Juneteenth holiday, and there's been so much talk of racism, especially in the last 4 years, and you know, I just want to know what is the end game? What do you guys want to when is your goal? What is your goal? I mean, you know, we have the Juneteenth holiday. What would you like to see so we can stop, you know, grinding on racism and, you know, just put it behind us? Because we all know slavery was horrible, you know, and now that we have the Juneteenth holiday, what is your guys going to
do? Oh, my. Jimmy, I apologize if you got cut off. We're having some technical difficulties here. Janelle, are you still there?
I am, yes.
Janelle, go ahead.
Okay. Well, first of all, thanks for that question, Jimmy, because I think I've heard that sentiment a lot, that people think we're beating a dead horse talking about racism. But I think the bottom, there are two things that I want to touch on. One, the bottom line is that not everyone truly believes that there was slavery. And I think that's hard for people to understand when you've been educated and you understand that it actually existed. But that story has been so mistold and convoluted that there are actually people who believe that slavery did not exist. People talk about how black people immigrated to the United States to become indentured servants. That is a rhetoric. That is a piece of history that has been mistold and lied about. So I think part of the end game is just telling our truth. I recently got onto Ancestry.com and I was trying to do my history. We were talking about this in the office and I said, there's only so far back that I can even go. And then my history just stopped. And that is because my history isn't in the books. We didn't have birth certificates and death certificates and historical data about immigration and, you know, our history past maybe my great-grandparents. And that is because my great-great-grandfather was born a slave. So for me, my history, my genetics, in connection to slavery is not that far gone. I am only three generations removed from that, and I'm 43 years old. I think that's hard for people to understand. When I hear people say, we've gotten past that, we're past Jim Crow, we're past those things, opportunities are there for everyone, I look them in the face and I say, my mom is 66 years old. She is the same age as Ruby Bridges. Ruby Bridges was the very first little black girl down south who decided to go, well, her parents sent her to a white school when she was 5 years old going into kindergarten, and she had to be escorted by National Guardsmen with guns because people were literally throwing eggs at the head of a little black girl at 5 years old. That was my mom's age. She was that age trying to integrate into other schools where people obviously didn't want it. That is my mom. So we are not that far removed from these racist actions. We are not far removed from a racist past. So I think we just want acknowledgement. We want people to say, we get it. There were some things that were done that prevented you and your culture from being able to succeed in this world. Let's do what we can to make it right. So acknowledgement is the first thing. And the second thing is to create some policies. So, you know, the city of Reading, the city council just approved an equity officer last week at the council meeting.
Fantastic.
And that equity officer position is going to be critical for our community. It's our opportunity to say, not just from a racial perspective, but from equity on an economic, socioeconomic, and not just black people, but we're talking Native Indigenous people, we're talking from the Latina community, our Asian community that is there. We are going to do everything we can to provide opportunity on an equitable basis for all of our youth in all of our high schools. That is something that is intentional. Intentionality is incredibly important. So acknowledging the racism, acknowledging things like Juneteenth are important steps in building those programmings that programming we need to build a more equitable future for our children and our youth.
Yeah, you know, and folks like Jimmy, some people just really don't understand because of our educational system and how poor it is. But, Juneteenth is not the end game.
Right.
We are so far from the end game. Every day in our nation, our great nation, people of color are discriminated in so many ways, both structurally and intentionally and explicitly and implicitly. And it's that implicit part that people have a hard time understanding that is driving our delusional thinking about, well, you know, and now everybody's got an equal playing field, and so people need to stop talking about racism. This has only just started. This is an opportunity, as Barbara Lee, representative from the Bay Area, this is an affirmation that of what we have been through, what the African American people have been through, and other people of color, but it's also an affirmation as to how far we have yet to go. This has got to be understood. And, you know, and we have fallen down on the job just miserably. And it's structural. In other words, we have Representative Doug LaMalfa voting against Juneteenth.
Mm-hmm.
Just amazing. And he's probably voting against Juneteenth because he feels the majority of his constituency up here doesn't want him to acknowledge it. But I think he has some implicit, if not explicit, problems regarding really race relationships that he has to deal with. Janelle, I'm going to ask you this. We're coming up on the bottom of the hour. Do you want to hold over and stay on for a couple of minutes, or can we get you in for another show? What would you like to do?
I can hang on for a few more minutes.
Okay, we're going to go ahead and take a real quick commercial break, and then we'll be back, and we'll see you in about 2 minutes.
Okay, sounds great.
Thank you.
I expected it to be a lot easier.
I didn't know what step to take next.
I was transitioning from the military. I was a vehicle gunner.
An avionics specialist.
I missed my unit, my family.
Playing with my daughter, I'd felt like a stranger.
I didn't have a clear sense of what to do next.
And then I thought, if I'm going through this, other veterans have gone through it too, right? So I reached out, and I saw that I wasn't alone.
Go to maketheconnection.net to learn how other veterans have overcome the challenges of transitioning out of the military.
These are unprecedented times. Challenging how the YMCA works to strengthen community as we have for nearly 170 years. But we've always found ways to help people and communities in times of crisis. Right now, Ys across the country are providing emergency childcare, shelter, food programs, and outreach to seniors. But we can't do it alone. Whether you're connected to the Y or have a fond Y memory, we need you to stay with us. Reach out to your local Y today and stay with us for a better us.
I'm Arielle Winter. If you're anything like me, your pets are not only your best friends, they're part of your family. American Humane, which has been rescuing animals like Cleo here for more than 100 years, has life-saving tips that can make a big difference in a disaster. When disaster strikes, you want to protect your whole family, including your pets. To help keep your family safe and help our best friends in their worst times, find tips at AmericanHumane.org.
I expected it to be a lot easier.
I didn't know what step to take next.
I was transitioning from the military. I was a vehicle gunner.
An avionics specialist.
I missed my unit. My family.
Playing with my daughter, I'd felt like a stranger.
I didn't have a clear sense of what to do next.
And then I thought, if I'm going through this, other veterans have gone through it too, right? So I reached out, and I saw that I wasn't alone.
Go to maketheconnection.net to learn how other veterans have overcome the challenges of transitioning out of the military.
Lift every voice and sing till earth and heaven ring. Ring with the harmony of liberty. Let our rejoice.
Back, and we've got Janelle for another couple of minutes with and then we're going to have another guest, Dr. Schwaller from Chico State University, is going to join us and talk a little bit about Juneteenth and critical race theory and a few other things. Janelle, are you there?
I am here.
So go ahead, RV.
RV again. You were talking about the diversity officer position that the city of Reading has created, and you said something about the K through 12 schools and stuff. I was wondering what that position is going to have to do with schooling.
Well, here's the thing that we've been talking in the city quite extensively about what the needs are in the community. And one of the things that we hear from the community a lot is that, especially our businesses, have a hard time finding a talented workforce. And I have children in the school system there in Reading. I have one that graduated in 2018, one just graduated last week from Enterprise High School, and then I've got a little one who's going into sixth grade. And one of the things that has always amazed me is how little access my children even have had to opportunities to build their professional resumes. And so in talking about our youth and trying to find ways to get our youth into the programs that will prepare them for the real world, one of the other issues we have is that within the city of Reading, we're not a very diverse organization. Last summer, when all of the talk around the George Floyd, situation, and then throughout the last year, we've had a lot of talk in the community about what is our RPD doing, what is our fire department doing, and we actually have done quite a bit. Chief Shuler is great about communicating with the community leaders and really finding ways to address problems as he sees them. Mm-hmm. But what we don't have is any one person to pull all of those ideas together in creating programming for our youth, ensuring that our police department has things like sensitivity trainings and trying to prevent issues before they start. We've got a huge homeless transient population who have a multitude of needs and come from diverse populations as well. So having an equity officer position totally makes sense for us organizationally.
Mm-hmm.
What that position will be able to do is work with every single department. We're talking outreach for underserved communities to engage in youth participation for some of our community services organization programming, so sports and parks and recreational activities. We're talking creation of talent pipelines to review policies, reviewing policies, procedures, and practices to promote things like diversity and ensuring inclusivity within the organization as a whole. For RPD, they're already starting their crisis response team, but that's talking about supporting mental health consumers, reducing fatal encounters. Our housing department is increasing stock and affordable housing opportunities. Again, just trying to find ways to bridge the gap between the city organizationally that is charged with doing things to help our community the best we can, and reaching out to some of those communities within our community that have historically felt like they have been left out of the mix and not addressed when we make some of these large economic construction decisions, particularly mm-hmm. things like downtown.
Right. That sounds like a lot of work for one person.
It's going to be a ton of work. But you know what? Here's the thing. That person will be charged with working with all of our department directors so that each department, as they make their goals and they work through their programming throughout the next few years, everyone is kind of working towards a common goal. It just keeps our focus so that we don't lose anybody in the mix. And I'm actually really excited about this equity officer position, also reaching out to our Native Indigenous people so that we can start to make decisions that that are culturally sensitive and understanding of the ground that we all walk, live, and play on every
single
day. It's
certainly long overdue.
Janelle, I can't thank you enough for being with us this morning. And we've got to have you back on for a full hour. Is that possible in the near future, do you think?
Probably, yeah. You should probably reach out, and we can definitely work something out.
Janelle, once again, what an honor, and thank you so very, very much. And, gosh, what a great way to start the morning.
Well, thanks for having me on. It was fun.
Yes, it was.
Okay. All right. Thank you. And, folks, now I think that I believe we have our second guest, Dr. Schwaller. I'm going to get that wrong. Dr. Schwaller, are you there?
Yeah, hello.
Hey, I am so sorry. Pronounce your last name for me.
Schwaller.
Schwaller, okay. And yeah. Dr. Schwaller, professor at Chico State University in the Multicultural and Gender Studies. And
lately a star of a news cafe.
A star of a news cafe. who's done a lot of study on ethnic relations and identity politics and all of that good stuff. Good morning, sir. How are you?
Good morning. I'm great. Happy Juneteenth.
Yes,
and thanks for having me. I'm honored and privileged to be here.
Well, sir, hopefully you're going to be back. But that's what we're hoping, and we'll as soon as we get that worked out, as possibly next week. Is that true?
That sounds good to me.
Okay, so sir, real quick, and I know RV is sitting across the table here, and I'm going to let RV start this thing off.
Oh, okay. Can I call you Sean?
Absolutely. Yeah, please call me Sean.
We spent the first half hour, or at least half of it, talking about Juneteenth. And explain to us from your point of view what the significance of this is.
It's
approval of the holiday.
Right. Well, it's important to celebrate. I'm totally behind it. I think it's also a reminder that we need to do more to combat systemic racism and wealth and health disparities and police brutality in terms of everything else that's going on. As Christian stated in the first half of the show, it's not an end game, but it's certainly important to celebrate, and also very disappointed with Doug LaMalfa's not only voting against it, but what he had to say about it in terms of, you know, supporting it would be furthering racial divisions, and that there's a confusion with different independence days. And it's just disappointing that, you know, he was one of the 14 representatives. A majority of those 14 were from the American South, were districts from the American South. So, you know, that kind of puts Doug LaMalfa in a kind of a bad spot.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree with that. I saw some Facebook posts on this, and you're the expert on this topic, so I wanted to ask this. Some people saw LaMalfa's vote and immediately just started blasting him for being a white supremacist. Is it correct to call LaMalfa a white supremacist?
I don't think there's necessarily enough evidence to say that, but I think a lot of racist people might like him. So I don't know, you know, Doug LaMalfa's ultimate thoughts outside of his voting, but there's probably some racist folks that like him.
You know, Sean,
and he's certainly dipping into white nationalist rhetoric with the stuff he said. So, I mean, I think he's close. I don't know if I'd go that far, but
right.
I think he's close.
Maybe, you know, goes back to that implicit or explicit. And I'm going to say that there's enough of the implicit to justify that his structural thinking is tilted towards white nationalism. I'm just going to say it. And Doug's been invited to come on the show, and of course we won't see him. But whether it's intentional or not, we'll have to wait and see. But I think, yeah, and maybe you could help us with this, Sean, is how is it that we internalize structural racism so that it affects us, you know, throughout our day?
Oh, well, we're taught it. I think also, you know, what Janelle brought up in terms of, you know, who we grow up around. Do we grow up in diverse settings? That's part of it. Socialization is part of it. What do we learn from our parents and families as we're growing up? And, you know, certainly pop culture as well. But it's very much a learned thing, whether it's implicit or explicit. You're certainly not born with it.
Yeah, and that's very important. We're not born racist. And in fact, I'm going to say there's a genetic component within us that is born to actually get along with people, unless you have social pathological type disorder of some sort, because we've got to get along with each other. We just got to, and that's what America's built on, or that was what some of the noble words in the Enlightenment thinking that built this nation. But we haven't lived up to it, and we're still not living up to it. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I was wondering if I could say something, address your caller, Jimmy.
Oh, yeah, please.
Absolutely.
Yeah, he said, you know, what do you guys want, and what do you want to, what would you like to see, and almost in a way kind of, you know, we've had a black president, we have Juneteenth, we're in this post-racial society now, which is totally a myth. And, you know, what I would like to see, you know, a little bit outside of Juneteenth, and when I teach my U.S. history courses, my students know quite a bit about the Civil War and slavery. They don't know anything about Reconstruction or what happened in the northern cities with residential segregation in their, you know, or Jim, or the sharecropping or Jim Crow segregation in the South in the early 20th century. So they're, what I'd like to see as a society is that we go further and we teach more about, you know, from Reconstruction onward, what was happening. And even, you know, when we talk about Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., everybody's heard the I Have a Dream speech or heard of it. But very few, or at least a lot less, know that he was marching on residential segregation in Chicago and also came out to Watts after the 65 Rebellion. So, you know, there were problems in California and there were problems in Chicago, and it wasn't just about the South, and it went way into the 20th century. So we need to continue to move on beyond just learning about, you know, slavery and freedom and look at how racism changed forms into the 20th century.
So to back up a little bit, to what we were talking to about LaMalfa, the question whether or not he was a white supremacist. You said that, and I agree with this part, that he is just maybe appealing to voters who are racist. And you've done quite a bit of writing now on the State of Jefferson movement that's been around for a while, and tying that in with this attempt to recall three supervisors. Here in Shasta County, Republican supervisors for not following the COVID regulations. You've been writing about this and watching what people say. How much implicit or explicit racism do you think is in this recall movement?
Like by percentage? I think there is...
Well, you have one guy, the Carlos Zapata, has made openly racist statements. And in fact, he's Hispanic, which is another can of worms. But I'm just curious about these voters that you think LaMalfa is appealing to.
I think to look broader, you know, like the recall movement, the militia, whatever it is, the Cottonwood militia.
Right.
The State of Jefferson, I think that there is explicit racism in all of that as a whole, and I think it's all, as folks have said, and even as Christian has said, and you've probably said as well, it, you know, they're all kind of connected, and it's all kind of birds of the same feather flocking together. I think there's a great deal of explicit racism. I mean, and I've kind of covered that, like you mentioned, in some of my ANC articles in terms of the State of Jefferson movement. I mean, blatantly racist posts on Facebook. And then what's to me is what is most significant about those posts on Facebook is it's not just the post, it's that, you know, 50 people gave it thumbs up or, you know, 40 people gave it thumbs up. And so when you start to look at that and you see the scale of it, it's much more kind of shocking in a way to see that community around that racist content on social media.
Yeah, and it's not all anonymous people either, which that is interesting that people feel so safe to be able to say these kind of things nowadays.
They've given a permission structure, especially within the last 4 years, in my opinion. Donald Trump is a racist, yeah, just flat out. And I think where we're having, you know, some issues is that I would go on to say that a majority of people that still support Donald Trump and think that he's going to be reinstated, in August? A majority of those individuals are supporting a structure of white nationalism that grew and bloomed under the Trump presidency, and it's dangerous, and it's fueling separation and division, and just because we have a Juneteenth national holiday, all that's not taken care of yet. You have to call it. Now, I know one Trump supporter that had quite a change of mind. I'm sitting across the table from him.
I wouldn't call it a supporter. It was fairly lukewarm support. This is the biggest mistake I ever made in my life. I voted for him. I thought changed. I thought he said some interesting things about trade. I liked his stuff about war. I'm one of those anti-war. I'm one of those guys that fell for it. And it's the deepest regret of my life.
I think it's really important that not all Trump voters can be put into that category, you know. But quite frankly, I'm going to have to say far too many. And listen, if we don't call it what it is and recognize it for what it is, how are we going to move forward? One of the things, and Sean, maybe you can correct me on this, but a saying that came from a saying that came from Malcolm X was that, you know, we all have to understand that to some degree or another, we are all racist. In other words, we have these internal things within us, either implicitly or excellent. And until we recognize that, how are we going to be able to deal it? How are we going to be able to move forward? I don't know.
Yeah, he probably did say that. He also said that liberals were more dangerous because they're going to smile and, you know, pull the knife out halfway, but you still got the knife in your back. But
there's a certain truth to that.
Yeah, I think a lot of folks have said that. I mean, you know, for me growing up in Red Bluff, going to Red Bluff High, graduating in the 90s, went off to college, and I majored in sociology because I was really just interested in people and how people work and interaction and identity and, you know, the self and society. And by the time I got to the end of my undergraduate education, I looked around and said, I don't feel like I've learned enough. I don't feel like I've learned enough about people. So I started I took African American history, Native American history, a course on race, power, privilege. I took a whole course on Malcolm X, which was incredible. And I finally thought, wow, this is like, I'm really learning about people now. And then I started thinking, well, why did I never learn about this before? You know, why have I not learned about this? And reflecting on that and, you know, instead of, you know, feeling guilty or attacked, I embraced it and, you know, continued to learn more and more about society and become more and more interested in race and ethnic relations, but also angry that I hadn't learned that and also realizing that I was very privileged to not have had to learn about the realities of people of color in society. And that's a privilege for a lot of white folks, is that they don't have to know what it's like to be black or brown in society, but black and brown folks have to know white realities to survive and live.
Exactly.
Now let me ask you one question about white privilege. I think for some people that, for whatever reason, that are ignorant or just malevolently racist or whatever, or just to say they're ignorant, it's like that's a lot. The idea of white privilege for, like, say, some poor white guy that's struggling to make a living, is that's hard to swallow. I mean, I wonder how you probably have to deal with that as an educator sometimes with students.
Yes, it is. And, you know, if you grew up in a predominantly white society or, you know, predominantly white community, you're going to deal with class conflict and class oppression. And, you know, I certainly saw that growing up in Red Bluff. It was much more white in the 90s. It's more diverse now, but a little bit at least. But it's not that white people don't struggle or have a hard time or, you know, like I said, struggle. But it's also bigger. It's a systemic historical thing. You know, if you go back through time and you see, you know, the 1862 Homestead Act giving away 200 plus million acres of land to citizens. Well, who could be citizens in 1862? You know, we're talking about Juneteenth and the Civil War and this stuff. Well, at the same time as this stuff was going on, 200 million plus acres were given away to white men and white European immigrant men across the Midwest that was taken from Native Americans.
Right.
You know, so that's the base of wealth for a great deal of families, even today. That's when they started accumulating their wealth with that federal policy. So it's a bigger thing. It's hard to swallow, I know, but it's also not about just one person and their experiences. It's a bigger historical structural issue.
You know, this is such an important issue, folks. That's why we're dedicating two shows back to back on this because this is the opportunity that history has given us, and we just got to do it, folks. And so I'm going to go ahead and announce that Dr. Schwaller will be with us next Saturday, and we're going to be talking about all of this in critical race theory, which is being used by the alt-right and a lot of Republicans to batter. I mean, they're calling the Vote for America Act now the Stacey Abrams Act. we're getting bludgeoned.
But actually, though, Stacey Abrams has come out and she's supporting Manchin's changes to that bill. It's going to include something Republicans used to hate: a national ID card, maybe.
Sean, we've got just about 5 minutes, so we're going to give you the 5 minutes. What are you going to take us home with?
Oh my goodness!
I'm sorry, but.
Well, to take it back to Juneteenth, I mean, I did listen to the first half of the show. Some of the things that I kind of want to emphasize is, you know, when General Gordon Granger shows up to Texas with the U.S. military, they were not surprising everybody that freedom had come, right, that slavery was over. They were there to enforce it because the Texas planters did not want to, you know, end slavery. And slavery in Texas, too, by the way, goes back to the end of the Mexican period in the 1830s before it was even the Texas Republic. But different topic, different day. But, you know, they were there to enforce it. They weren't just there to say, hey, guess what? You know, the Emancipation Proclamation was passed. And Granger also had thousands of black soldiers with him, and there were thousands and tens of thousands of black soldiers that fought in the Civil War. So let's be cautious in terms of focusing on this white guy that comes in and be careful to kind of stay away from that white savior thing, that it was, you know, African Americans were involved in this entire thing as well. And I think that's really important to put it into that perspective.
Yeah. You know, and so I'm really looking forward to next week. Just a couple of thoughts here real quick on critical race theory. Just give us a couple. And before we do that, Sean, I've got to apologize. We started out with technical difficulties. We got a late start. And we weren't able to take all the phone calls that we would like to take. And so please, folks, call in next Saturday, because that's going to be an opportunity to talk to an authority on the situation. Okay, sir, what do we got for the next 3 minutes?
Yeah, I would love to next week take callers, and I'm excited to be here next week, talk with you guys again. You know, a simple, in a way, the definition of critical race theory is in the term itself. I mean, it's the critical exploration of race and ethnicity as it relates to cultural, societal, and legal issues. And that's what it is. And the folks on the alt-right and other folks that don't like it or don't want to accept it, they're not wanting to accept reality and the truth. I mean, there's no really other way to put it.
Things that have been discovered through the lens of critical race theory end up, you know, with things we didn't know about before, about the history of slavery, and so that ends up in the schools, and then the subject is not critical race theory, it's just a historical fact, but these the people that are against critical race theory are attacking that as critical race theory, but it isn't.
You know,
yeah, and you know, there's lots of studies out there that show that students are better off and feel better about themselves by learning these things, especially students of color. You hear a lot of folks saying, well, you're teaching them to be victims and have a victim mentality. And, you know, that was the argument in Arizona when they tried to ban Chicano studies a couple years ago, and then it was ruled unconstitutional. But, you know, students of color feel more empowered when they learn their history. And it's not just about oppression. It's also about culture contributions and culture and music and art. I mean, it's not just, you know, battling white supremacy.
Yeah, and feeling empowered enough maybe to register and vote and take part in this great democracy experiment called the United States of America.
Absolutely.
You know, in fact, most Americans didn't. If you would have said the Greenwood District massacre, you know, before last month, the majority of Americans would go, huh? You know, this is This is something that is part of getting woke, folks. And we're at the bottom of the hour. Sean, thank you so much. We look forward to next week. And folks, once again, sorry for the technical difficulties. We'll have it squared away before next week. Thank you for Sean. Thank you for being here. And callers, thank you for calling in. This is Common Ground Radio. Until next week, RV, say bye.
Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.
KCNR, Shasta, Reading.